So we're pleased to have Edward Frankel for part two of his lecture series.
Thank you. Well, I guess I've managed to scare a wizard. Right. Well, thanks for coming, those who weren't scared away. Let me start by summarizing what I explained last time. And I want to put this in the framework of Andrei Bey's idea of analogies between different parts of mathematics, and which we have sort of augmented by adding physics as well. That we have the world of number theory, and we have a bridge to geometry through curves over finite fields. Then we finally go to geometry of Riemann surfaces and various objects related to them, which we'll talk more extensively about today. And then we have physics, quantum physics. And so the original or classical Langlands program is something that is pertinent to these two fields, originally started in number theory, and because of close analogy between number fields and function fields for curves over finite fields, actually everything can be stated in both contexts. Then the geometric Langlands program has to do with curves. Here curves over finite fields, and here curves over the complex field, or Riemann surfaces. And so that's a generalization of the classical Langlands program, which is formulated in a geometric context. Numbers are not yet, we haven't yet found a way to describe number fields quite geometrically, so that's why we kind of have the geometry so far here. But of course the idea is that eventually we would be able to transport some of the ideas which come up here to the original framework. And I should say that this subject has been developing since the 80s, due in large part to people like Deligne, Drumfeld, Bellinson, Lamont, and others. And now we have a new ingredient which combines geometry of Riemann surfaces and physics, and that's this new theory of Witten and others, which I'm going to talk about today, which has to do with S-duality and mirror symmetry. So that's roughly the outline of what we know about this picture now. And so eventually, of course, the idea is that somehow we'll be able to extend this brackets to this entire all four tracks. So now, yesterday I talked mostly about this. I was mostly in this setting, and this setting, and I just started describing the geometric Langlands program. So now I would like to explain in more detail what this geometric Langlands program is about, and then I will talk about the work of Kapust and Witten on mirror symmetry of the Hitchian moduli spaces, and I will explain in what way this mirror symmetry, which in turn comes from S-duality of Super-Young-Mills theories, sheds new light on the geometric Langlands correspondence. So what is the geometric Langlands correspondence? So let me now start here. Let X be a Riemann surface, a compact Riemann surface. Or, since I want to look at it algebraically, I'll say a smooth projective algebraic curve over C. And G will be
complex reductive E group. For example, the group GLN.
N by N, invertible matrices over complex numbers.
And then I have the Langlands dual group, LG.
Yesterday I gave examples of how this duality works. So for example, GLN is self-dual and SLN corresponds to PGLN and so on. The general prescription is roughly the following. First of all, for a Lie group, you have the corresponding Lie algebra. And at the level of Lie algebras, this Langlands duality takes a Lie algebra to another Lie algebra whose Cartan matrix is a transpose of the original Cartan matrix. So the level of Lie, or if you think in terms of Dynkin diagrams, you need to invert the arrows. So the only non-trivial transformation happens in B and C series, the odd orthogonal and symplectic, where you have a twofold arrow, and then the arrow could go this way or that way, and so you switch them, so you switch between B and C. But then a Lie group has a little more data because, say, a simple Lie group has more data than just a Lie algebra because you have, for example, a simply connected Lie group, and then it may have a center, which is a finite subgroup, and then you can quotient by the center or by some subgroup of the center. And so this duality, what it does is that the group which has the biggest possible center, the simply connected one, gets switched with the one which is quotient by the center, like SLN and PGLN, or PSLN. And then if it's something in the middle, let's say you take, say n is even, then you can take SLN, say n is even, you can take SLN mod Z2, and the dual one would be SLN modulo, the center is Zn, and kind of Zn mod Z2 is Zn over 2. So that's what you take. So it's kind of, there's some cases in between. All right. So now, the Langlands, the geometric Langlands correspondence relates two kinds of data. So on the left-hand side, we'll have the data which are the analogs of the Galois data we had in the classical story, which I already explained last time. Namely, we take the fundamental group of X, and I recall that this is a geometric analog of the Galois group, say of Q bar over Q, which we encounter in this story. And so in the classical story, we take homomorphisms from the Galois group to LG, to the Langlands dual group. Now we take homomorphisms from the fundamental group, the geometric analog of the Galois group, to LG. So this actually can be described in very concrete terms because we know that a Riemann surface can be cut in a certain way. So there's some natural loops that you can draw on the Riemann surface. And so you can represent the fundamental group by some generators with one relation. You'll have two G generators with one relation. And so defining such a homomorphism is just associating to each generator an element of LG in such a way that the relation is satisfied. Then, of course, when I put the brackets, what I mean is equivalence classes of such objects. So then you would have to mod out by the adjoint action of LG. So kind of conjugacy classes, equivalence classes of such homomorphisms. There is, however, a different way to describe this, which is more differential geometric, which will be more convenient for us, which is to say that you get homomorphisms from the fundamental group from bundles with lead connection. So we're going to replace this object by this differential geometric objects, namely flat bundles, bundles with flat connection. So what I mean by that is a pair, E and Nabla, where E is a principal LG bundle. And now, so it's going to be a bundle on X, and X is the Riemann surface, it's a complex algebraic variety, and G is a complex Lie group, so it makes sense to talk about holomorphic bundles. So this is going to be principal holomorphic, which in fact is going to be exactly the same as algebraic, because we have algebraic structure on X as well. Algebraic algae bundle. So you may prefer to think as holomorphic, you may think about it. We may prefer to think of it as algebraic. This is the same bundle. On X. A nabla is a holomorphic connection. And again, holomorphic or algebraic, doesn't matter. You may think one way or the other, depending on your taste. Connection on E. Right? So this nabla, in other words, is the nabla DBZ. I'm just specifying the holomorphic part of the connection, 1-0 part of the connection, because my bundle already comes with a holomorphic structure. Defining holomorphic structure on this bundle is the same as defining holomorphic structure is the same as defining the 0-1 part of the connection. Because what does it mean to say that bundle is holomorphic? It means that I know which sections are holomorphic. And those sections are annihilated by some d-bar operator. This d-bar operator I can take as the anti-holomorphic part of the connection, and I take my connection nabla as a holomorphic part of the connection. Because it's holomorphic, they will commute, right? And so together, I can think of them as the 1-0 and 0-1 parts of a flat connection. So in other words, defining a holomorphic connection and a holomorphic bundle is the same as defining a flat connection on just a smooth bundle. So it gives rise to a flat bundle. Flat connection. And if you have a flat connection, you can look at horizontal sections of your bundle, sections which are annihilated by the connection operators. Equivalently, you look at holomorphic sections which are annihilated by this operator nabla, which is the 1-0 part of the connection. And so you have your Riemann surface, and you have a bundle. And now you have an operator which will annihilate some sections, and those are the horizontal sections, right? And so locally, it's just kind of like give you periodization of your bundle, but a family of identification of the nearby fibers. But if you go sort of far away and come back, then you may get a non-trivial transformation of the fiber. And so what you get is a holomorphism from the fundamental group of X to LG. So there's an equivalence between the category of such representations and the category of flat bundles or flat holomorphic bundles. But we will use the second description for reasons which will become more clear later. Okay, so these are the data on one side of the Langlands correspondence. So then, what are the data on the other side? So remember, in the classical story, the Galois representations, the idea was to describe Galois representations in terms of harmonic analysis. So to Galois representations, you wanted to associate some automorphic representation of the group G. Or oftentimes you could encode this representation by some classical automorphic form, like a modular form or something like this. So what we need to find is a geometric analog of this. Of these objects, automorphic representations, automorphic functions, modular functions. And it turns out that what plays a role of those are objects which are called Hecke eigensheaves. So I'll give you the name and then I'll explain what they are. Hecke eigensheaves. On bund G. So here, bund G is a notation for the moduli space of G bundles on X. Of principle, when I say G bundle, I mean principle G bundle. So, of course, when I say moduli space, I'm not being precise. The point is that in the geometric story, we want to treat all these objects as algebraic varieties. And so we want to make sense of this as an algebraic variety of some sort. But unfortunately, it is not possible. There is no algebraic variety whose points parameterize equivalence classes of all G bundles on X, unless unless G is abelian, C star, for example, right? So in the non-abelian case, you cannot do this. So the reason is that G bundles have automorphisms. They have automorphisms, and different G bundles have different automorphisms. So the problem is that, say, if you have line bundles, which are C star bundles, they all have the same group of automorphisms, which is C star. So that, so this issue of group of automorphisms, in some sense, goes away. And in fact, we know that there is a very, there is a nice moduli space, which is called the Picard variety. But for in a non-abelian case, the best you can do is to have some kind of algebraic geometric object, which is a little bit more sophisticated than algebraic variety. In other words, algebraic variety is something which is defined by a system of algebraic equations. But there's something very close to it, which is an algebraic variety divided by an action of an algebraic group. So for example, if it's a finite group, this is what's also called in differential geometry, orbifold. So it's something which may have singular points, and, but this, the singularity is caused by the group, by the fact that some points have automorphisms, non-trivial automorphisms. Now, it turns out that there is some algebraic geometric theory for such objects, and which are called algebraic stacks. And in fact, there exists an algebraic stack which parameterizes all G bundles on X. And for all intents and purposes, for all the things that we would like to do with it, actually the fact that it is an algebraic stack and not an algebraic variety is not really a big handicap. So we can define, what we will really be interested in is to study some sheaves on this object. And this relevant categories of sheaves can be defined on algebraic stacks. So it's not a, somehow it doesn't happen to be a big problem for us. So we might as well think of it as a kind of algebraic variety, perhaps quotiented out by some algebraic group. Although it's not exactly true, it's sort of local. It has a description that it is covered by some open sets, each of which is a quotient like that. All right. So that's what Banji is. Of course, the question immediately, so this is a nice, very nice geometric object because it's a very natural thing to do. You have a curve X, and you look at all bundles, G bundles on X. For example, if G is GLN, you just look at vector bundles of rank N. And so you have a set of equivalence classes of such. And what we're saying is that this set actually comes from some algebraic, almost like an algebraic variety. But, of course, the question remains, why? How is it related to the notions of classical Langlands program? In the classical Langlands program, we talked about automorphic representations. And so there's an immediate question, why do automorphic representations get replaced by this moduli space? And in fact, there's a very simple explanation, which also incidentally goes back to André Weil, but in a different letter. Actually, it wasn't a letter, it was a paper. So the point is that I didn't really explain what automorphic representations are, but these are representations of a group, right? And so what is the group? The group is the group G over the adels. And at this point, it's not so important what the adels are.
Hmm? And who is she?
Who is she?
Who is Adele?
This Adele. Yeah. There is a story about this, that somebody, it was somebody's girlfriend was called Adele, and that's why they call it. But I don't know if it's true or not. So, it sounds like a good story. So, it doesn't matter what it is, but actually it's actually very easy to describe in the geometric context. The point is that if you have a Riemann surface, what's relevant really is a field of meromorphic functions, as we discussed already last time. So this is sort of a global object. F is this field of meromorphic functions. Functions on X. Very natural objects, right? So it's a field, of course. So you can add functions, multiply functions, and so on. But it has local analogs. Meromorphic functions have local analogs. You can expand them in a Taylor's, in a Laurent series near any point. So actually, there is an analog of F, namely F sub X, which would be just the formal Laurent power series with respect to some coordinate near point X. And so, in fact, any meromorphic function gives rise to such a power series. In fact, it gives rise to a convergent power series. So in any case, the formal power series. And so you can think of this as completions of this field. And what is the ring of Adels? The Adels ring of Adels is just the product of these completions, essentially. It's what's called the restricted product. But let's not worry about this. Okay, so there is a natural subring here, Taylor series, the ones which only have no negative powers. Okay, and so you have this O also, which is a product of all subrings. And now the point is that F.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. What is that?
Which this is a Taylor series, which means only non-negative powers are allowed. No pole, right? So the meromorphic functions embed into all power series. You can just look at the diagonal embedding into this product, right? And so in particular, so you have the group over the Adels, which is like a product of loop groups over all points, product of formal loop groups over all points of the curve. Something people have, for example, looked at also in conformal field theory. It's a very natural thing to do. And inside, you have the subgroup G over this. So it embeds, because this embeds, so this embeds. So what we can do is form the quotient, this quotient. And the point is, so the automorphic representation is a representation which is realized in functions on this quotient. So you see, you have taken the quotient on one side, so the group still acts on the right. So you can take some sort of some space of functions on this quotient. This is in a classical story. So in other words, when X is actually over a finite field, that's what we do. We take functions on this quotient. Things are defined exactly the same way, except you replace complex numbers by finite field. Right? And so the group acts. And because the group acts, you can ask what are the representations which show up in this decomposition. So this is actually going to be to have some discrete part, some discrete spectrum. And then there will be some continuous spectrum, will be some direct integral of some representation. Continuous. And so in particular, your favorite Eisenstein series will be in the continuous spectrum. And the cuspidal representations, which I talked about yesterday, will be in the discrete spectrum. Right? So these are the automorphic representations. These are representations which show up in the space of functions. Now, but we actually, we're studying now the geometric Langlands correspondence. We're studying actually the kind of a slightly simplified version of this, which is called unramified. Because if you remember, yesterday we talked about Galois groups and how Galois groups have to do with coverings. And coverings could be ramified. But since we restrict ourselves to just the fundamental group, it means that we look at unramified coverings only. So the counterpart of this on the automorphic side of the Langlands correspondence is that we only look at so-called unramified representations, only look at, for now, only look at unramified representations. And unramified representation means that it has sort of a highest weight vector. It has a vector V which is stable under the subgroup G of O. So you see, inside the Adels, we have two different subrings. One comes from the global thing, which is meromorphic functions on the entire curve. But then we also have something which is sort of local with the condition of no pole at each point, which is this O. And we have already used up G of F, we have taken the quotient. But we haven't used this one. So the point is that amongst all representations, there are such for which contain invariant vector under the subgroup. And if so, if it occurs here, first of all, it occurs, entire representation occurs in this space of functions. But then this vector would give rise to a function which is also right invariant under this subgroup. Right? So the upshot of all this is that this V then, given that pi is automorphic, and given that there exists such V which has this property, means that V actually gives rise to a G of O. So right G of O invariant function on this quotient, which is the same as just the function on the double quotient. So in fact, this is very similar to encoding, say, a cuspidal representation of GL2 over adels by a modular form. What you are doing is actually realizing particular vector in this representation as a function in upper half plane. But this one vector knows everything because you can get, because the representation is irreducible, you can get all other vectors by applying other elements of this group, G of A. So once you know this vector, you know everything. Right. So that's sort of a signature of your representation. It's a kind of very economical way to encode your representation by some kind of by a function. And in an unramified case, it's very natural to take this vector, which is invariant under the subgroup, and what this gives you is a function of the double quotient. So this whole explanation was to convince you that, at least in an unramified case, automorphic representations are encoded by functions on this double quotient. And then the point is, and what André Weil recognized a long time ago was that actually this double quotient is nothing but a set of equivalence classes of G-bundles. So that's why this moduli space of G-bundles shows up, because the observation is that this double quotient is just the set of equivalence classes of G-bundles, and now we're just looking at the algebra geometric object which has as points such equivalence classes. So that's why in the geometric story, this double quotient coming from the theory of automorphic representations gets replaced by Bunge. So that's why we get one. But of course, the point. So you already see that what happens is that in a classical story, the relevant object is a function on this double quotient. But in a geometric story, it's going to be a sheaf on this. So a sheaf is an object of a category. In fact, we'll see that the sheaves are nothing but D-brains. And of course, in physics language, D-brains are also objects of categories. In recent years, physicists realized that when they talk about brains, the proper formalism is formalism of categories, in fact, derived categories. So it's no surprise that brains are objects of derived categories. So what's sort of new here is that this passage from the classical correspondence to the, which happens for number fields and curves or finite fields, to the geometric correspondence entails a kind of categorification where functions get replaced by sheaves. And there's sort of a long story why, and many reasons to believe why in geometric theory functions should be replaced by sheaves. But one way to think about it is that how do you characterize functions? Well, in the classical story, this is just going to be a subset, and it's going to be a function on this set. When we pass from curves over a finite field to complex curves, the most natural thing would be to think, well, maybe, because this is going to be sort of a complex algebraic variety, you might think naively that maybe it should be sort of a holomorphic function. But of course not, because there are no holomorphic functions, only constants. And so the point is that what happens when you pass to the geometry is that these functions, there will be some functions, but there will be functions which will have some singularities, and maybe monodromies around some divisors and so on. So in fact, it's not a proper way to describe them by their values, because they may not have well-defined values everywhere. But it may be much better to describe them by equations which they satisfy. And so in geometry, in the geometric story, the proper notion to replacing notion of a function is not a notion, it's not a function, but the differential equation which it satisfies. And the differential equation is formalized in the notion of a D-module. So what starts life in classical story as an automorphic function becomes in a geometric story a D-module. Let's call it D-module. Which it's instructive to think of a PowerD module as a kind of an object which encodes a system of linear PDEs. A D module on Banji, because the function was on this double quotient. So in the geometric story, it will become system differential equations on this Banji, the geometric object which replaces this double quotient. So this is what these Hilkertian shifts are in the geometric story. They are D modules. Now, what do I mean by D module? D stands for the shift of differential operators. So if you have, say, just on an affine space, on a CN, differential operators are, you know, polynomial functions and derivatives. So the Weyl algebra, everything you can get from x and d dx. And the D module would be a module over the algebra of differential operators. And for a general variety, you cover it by open sets. And for each open set, it looks like CN. And you have algebra of differential operators. So for each open set, you should have a module over this. And they have to glue nicely. So that's what the D module is. And oftentimes, this is actually a good way to represent a system of linear differential equations. Because, for example, as we just discussed, oftentimes you have differential equations, even of first order, coming from connections, for example, whose solutions are multivalued. So if you go around, you get some monodromies. So the solutions are really nicely described on small open subsets. And then you describe how they glue together. And then you can have some monodromies when you go far away and come back. Right? So similar story also holds for differential equations with some singularities. Unlike, say, bundles with flat connection have no singularities, but more general, say, you can allow some regular singularity or irregular singularity. So this is all uniformly described by this formalism of D modules. So a Hilkertian shift, first and foremost, is a D module on Banji. But then there is an additional property, which is this Hilkertian property, which is also a direct analog of the property of this function. When I described the passage from an automorphic representation to this function, I didn't mention any properties of this function. But in fact, this function has some important properties, because it's not just some random function, it actually came from a particular vector of an irreducible representation. And this is a so-called this function is a Hilkertian function. Hilkertian, of course, it refers to the classical notion of Hilkertian operator in the theory of modular forms. And the Hilkertian operators which show up here in the geometric story are just some natural generalizations of the classical Hilkertian operators. So the functions in the classical story are Hilkertian functions. Therefore, the D modules or the sheaves which show up in the geometric story have to be Hilkertian sheaves. Right? So now I have to explain what Hilkertian sheaf, what this Hilkertian property is. And you can understand it without knowing anything about the classical Hilkertian operators. In fact, it's very natural. The point is that, as always, if you have a category, you often have some nice functors on this category, acting on this category. And then if you have an object of the category, it makes sense to talk about an eigenobject, sort of an object which transforms in a very nice way under these functors. And kind of jumping a little bit ahead, when we will talk about the physics counterpart of all this, we will see that the category of D modules will really be a category of brains of certain kind in some signal model. And these operators will be some line operators in this theory. And in fact, this will be they will come from the so-called Hooft operators in the four-dimensional super Young Mills. But the essential point here is that on the category of D modules, on Banji, we have natural functors. And these are called the Hilkertian functors. And they are parameterized by two pieces of data. One is a representation of the dual group, just like Hooft operators, are parameterized by representation of the dual group. And the other one is a point of the curve. And so F is called a Hilkertian sheaf if the following holds, that if you apply this operator to F, Naively, you would just say, you just have to get back F. Right? But that's too strong a condition. A more reasonable condition would be to say that you get not F, but a direct sum of copies of F, which is the same as saying that it's F tensor some vector space. And then, for some tautological reasons, you can actually see that the vector space can be nothing but the vector space underlying this representation. So, a Hecketian sheaf is an object of this category, a D-module in this case, or in the physics incarnation, it would be actually an A-brain, which has this property that when you apply this operator for any V and X, it gets multiplied tensored with a vector space. And this vector space is the V, one of the parameters of this operator. So we can now finally say what the geometric Langlands conjecture tells us. It tells us that given an object of this set of equivalence classes, let's call it E, starting with an object on the left-hand side, which is again a bundle with a connection, we should be able to produce a Hecketian sheaf on band G. In other words, a D module on band G, which has this property, nice property with respect to this funny operator, this Hecke operator. When you apply to it, you get back your sheaf tensor vector space. So let's call this F sub E. So that's a statement of the geometric Langlands correspondence. Are there any questions? You guys seem to be too quiet. So I'm getting worried.
Maybe an example?
Example. Very good. So in fact, the best kept secret in this field is that there are no elementary non-trivial examples. And in fact,
I don't think it's a secret.
It's not a secret anymore because I've given similar talks before. But so there are some that trivial elementary examples in some sense. But to get non-trivial sort of nice examples, you actually have to work with the mirror symmetry and S-duality. So one of the reasons why I believe that this connection between S-duality and geometric Langlands is so useful is because actually, whereas if you work with D-modules, these guys are always nasty and very hard to describe. In the S-duality picture, the corresponding brains are actually very nice. And this is what I will try to convince you so in the remaining time. So that's why, so there's a hope that this is somehow the right language, that the A-brains, which come out from physics, are actually much better a formalism than the formalism of D-modules, which sort of comes up more naturally from a mathematical point of view. Or perhaps we can learn something about these D-modules by looking at the A-brains, and vice versa.
But what about this whole work on separation of variables better than
right, so that's what I was going to mention this. So there's old work by old people about there are some cases where you can actually write down the systems of differential equations, because as I said, D-module is kind of a fancy term for a system of differential equations. So if, for example, X has genus 0, but then you have some ramification points, something I have excluded in this discussion, but you could restore if you wanted, then actually you could write down these differential equations, and they have to do with some integrable systems, some nice integrable systems, particularly so-called Godin models, which are certain degenerations of XXX or XXC spin chains, and kind of they are higher rank generalizations to other compact groups. So in this case, actually, this differential equations and the solutions of differential equations kind of, and the whole picture which comes from this Langlands correspondence fits nicely into some fits nicely with some results obtained by people working in integrable systems. For example, Skryanin had found some separation of variables for these systems, and this has an interpretation in terms of the geometric Langlands correspondence. So this, I would say, is probably the only class where you can actually sort of touch these D-modules. Kind of for higher genus, they are really kind of hopeless. Okay. So there is, however, another case where things are also work nicely, which is the abelian case. In the abelian case, this band G is essentially just a Jacobian variety. And these D-modules are actually going to be just line bundles with a flat connection. So they can be described also in very nice terms. Yes?
But on the left-hand side, the echo operator and all these things, we know what they are. You know
on the left-hand side?
Yes, I mean, okay, this...
It depends how you look at it.
Well,
yes, on the left? Or
the thing that you raised, I mean, the echo operator on the automorphic form.
Oh, yes. That's
so
right.
We have a level. So, for example, is the level of the echo operator the dimension of the vector space?
No, level was... No. The level comes to... If you take operator HP, you know. Yeah. The point is that the analog of a point on the curve is a prime. Prime corresponds to a prime ideal in the ring of integers, just like prime here, a point here corresponds to a prime ideal in the ring of functions, right? Yeah. So Hegel operators are parameterized by primes, and then you can do kind of composite operators for general integer, not necessarily prime. Right. So if you take the Hegel operator corresponding to a prime p, this will be the analog of this operator for a point x. And of course, Hegel operators are for GL2, so you take SV, the two-dimensional representation. So that's the analogy. Okay. So we have this, and so this was the formulation that was developed by mathematicians. And in fact, so what you need to show is that for each such thing, there exists such an object, right? And so, so this has been proved actually in some cases. So, for example, for GLN, we know this. It's a work of Dennis Gaitkari, Kari Villan, and myself. And for other groups, Bellinson and Drinfeld were able to prove this in the case when this bundle, this connection, has some special additional structure, which kind of corresponds to a half-dimensional subspace in the space of all such objects. They're called OPERs. But, of course, many questions here. First of all, what does this all mean? Why should this exist? Why the dual group and so on and so forth? And that's where, so I'd like to explain that how this actually comes out naturally from physics. But before I do that, we just look at it just at the sort of basic level, and we see that these two sides are very asymmetric. It's something we already discussed yesterday. Because what we have here is a point of some moduli space, right? So this E is actually a point of the moduli space, which I'll call, let's call it YLGX, which is the moduli space, and again, it's really a moduli stack, but let's just not worry about this, moduli space of LG bundles, flat LG bundles, next. So you see, on this side, you actually have also moduli space of flat bundles, but what you do is just take a point of this moduli space. So that's what you have on the left-hand side. That's what it looks like, you just take a point. But on the right-hand side, you get some D module, so you get an object of some category. So it looks like correspondence between points of one moduli space and sheaves on another moduli space. It looks very unnatural. So the first thing we'd like to do is to make it look more natural and more symmetric. And there is an obvious way to do it. Because there is a points naturally give rise to, you know, zero brains. They naturally give rise to objects of a natural category, namely category of coherent sheaves. Just a skyscraper sheaf sitting at the point. So what we can do is try to promote this correspondence to an equivalence of categories, where on this side we have the category of D modules on bunch G. But on this side we have a natural category which in particular has objects parameterized by points of this variety, right? So this category is a category of coherent sheaves or category of all modules. And this is already very close to the category of brains because we know that coherent sheaves, or more precisely, objects of the corresponding derived category, are the B brains, the brains which arise in the B twisted sigma mode. Okay, so let's look at the category. I'll call it Koch of Y L G F. So this is the category of coherent sheaves, or same four modules. On this moduli space. And then here we'll have category of D modules on bunch. So this is category of D modules. Okay. So now the point is that given any point
here you have a natural object of this category,
namely skyscraper sheaf. So this is your moduli space. You have a point, and you sort of have an object which just lives at this point. Okay. And here you have, so what you can hope is that not only to each point there corresponds some object of this, but in fact there is an equivalence of categories, so that under this equivalence, this O sub E goes to this object S. But then there are other objects here which go to some more general objects here. Right? So of course, to make it work, we have to first of all pass through the derived categories. So it's really derived. We have to take derived categories, but derived categories. And the nice thing about this is that in this context, in this framework, we can give a very natural explanation to this Hecke property. Because for now, this looks very unnatural. We start with something which is a point of this, and then this object all of a sudden has to satisfy some property that some operators take it to itself, tensor some vector space. But if we take this point of view, that actually this comes from this more general equivalence of categories, we can give a very simple explanation. And the explanation goes as follows, that, as I said, on this category we have this Hecke operator, so Hecke functors. But also, on this side, we have a family of operators parameterized by the same data. And these operators, mathematicians have known all along, but didn't have a name for them. But now, because now Witt and Kapustin have related all this stuff to Young Mills, there's a good name for them, the Wilson operators. So these are the operators. These operators come from Wilson lines in four-dimensional Young Mills, as Kapustin and Witten have shown. So these are the Wilson operators. And so now we can explain more naturally what's going on, because we will demand that conjecture that not only we have an equivalence of these categories, but that under this equivalence, Wilson operators will correspond to Hooft operators. Again, something you certainly expect to happen under S-duality. How does this help us? How does this explain the Hecke property? Well, the point is that these guys are obviously eigenobjects of the Wilson operators, because Wilson operator, from the point of view of this category, Wilson operator just multiplies everything by a vector bundle on this, viewed as a coherent sheaf. So if you have a skyscraper sheaf, you know, so you multiply skyscraper sheaf by a vector bundle, but because it's supported at the point, it only sees this fiber of this vector bundle. So the sheaf itself gets multiplied by the fiber, which is a vector space. So these guys are obviously eigen sheaves, or eigen brains, if you will. Therefore, this should also be eigen. In other words, if we believe that this equivalence intertwines the action of Wilson operators and Hecke operators, is that clear? No, you kind of look puzzled. If you have an equivalence which intertwines these operators, and you have one object which is an eigenshift, then its mirror image has to be an eigenshift. But this is a property which is much more difficult to verify. This Hooft operators are, well, we know in Young Mills, for example, these Hooft operators are very non-local, unlike the Wilson operators. But if we believe that this duality intertwines the two, then it has to happen that this skyscraper sheaf, the simplest possible object, goes to this. And so this already indicates that this correspondence has a flavor of Fourier transform. And the Fourier transform, the delta function, which is sort of in some sense the simplest function, goes to some character, some exponential function, which is kind of spread out everywhere. So that's what happens here. An object which is supported at a particular point of one moduli space goes to something which is somehow spread out everywhere in a complicated way. In fact, this is connection to Fourier transform is not just some kind of a nice analogy. It's actually much more precise. The point is that while this is a conjecture for a general group G, it is actually a theorem when G is abelian. So for abelian, for G, say C star, this is a theorem. And it is, in fact, nothing but the Fourier-Mukai transform. A kind of a slightly more sophisticated version, a kind of D-module version of Fourier-Mukai transform, which was proved by Lamont and Rothstein. So what we're dealing with here is a non-abelian version of the Fourier-Mukai transform, which of course agrees also with the way one can think about S-duality as a kind of a non-abelian version of Fourier transform. Because abelian S-duality, you can sort of you can prove by using path integral by some sort of Fourier transform. Okay, so now this is better. So now we have cast everything in terms of categories and in terms of some operators acting on these categories. And that's where we can now use the insights which come from S-duality. So let me recall the basic setup of the work of Kapustin-Witten, which I already mentioned at the beginning of my yesterday's talk. They start with a super Young-Mills theory on a four-manifold, which is a product of two Riemann surfaces, one of which is our friend X, the Riemann surface X, and the other one is another Riemann surface sigma. Right. So Kapustin-Witten studies super Young-Mills theory, n equal 4, twisted super Young-Mills theory on the product of X and sigma, where sigma is another Riemann surface. And then they look at the limit when X becomes very small. And so what they get is an effective theory on sigma, a two-dimensional theory, in fact, two-dimensional sigma model on sigma, which describes maps from sigma to a certain moduli space, which is called the Hitchin moduli space, MH of G. So what is MH of G? MH of G is, in fact, is the moduli of objects which are very close to object we have looked at so far. We have looked at, for example, at this moduli space of flat bundles. So I recall that this E, a flat bundle, is a pair. It's a G bundle and a connection. And now this MH of G is described as a pairs of E phi, where E is again a bundle, is a G bundle, and phi is called a Higgs field. So that's sort of a mathematician's version of Higgs field, and what it is really a section of the adjoint bundle. It's a one form with values in the adjoint bundle. This is a canonical line bundle of differential forms, holomorphic differential forms, or cotangent bundle to, X to X, and then this is just the adjoint bundle, so it's like E cross G, the algebra. So that's what this is. So this is a conventional description of the Hitchin moduli space of Higgs bundles. A Higgs bundle is a pair, a bundle and a Higgs field, which is very close to a bundle and a connection, because connection is like a one form, but it's sort of it can identify connections with one forms, but non-canonically. But in fact, there is much more closer link between the two, and the point is that actually this is a hyperkeller manifold. And so it has a CP1 of complex structures. And there are sort of three preferred ones, which we call I, J, and K. And so, of course, when you choose different complex structure, you get a different complex manifold. As smooth manifolds will be isomorphic, but different complex manifolds. And they'll have different descriptions. So the description I've given you here corresponds to the complex structure I. But in the complex structure J, it's a different complex structure amongst this P1 of complex structures. This is actually this moduli space of just flat bundles. So the same moduli space actually can be thought of as moduli of Higgs bundles and also flat connections. And the fact that the two are actually isomorphic is called non-abelian Hodge theory. Right? So this is a moduli of flat bundles. So it has two different incarnations. It's a moduli of Higgs bundles, moduli of flat connections. Now there is a subtle point which I kind of sweeping under the rug, which is that this is this is really true. This, you have to be careful that to show this, an important point is to impose some stability condition. And so I have described here this as a moduli space without any stability condition. But at this point, if you want to identify these two, you have to impose some stability condition. But sort of a technical point, which I will ignore. All right. So how does this relate? So how does this moduli space enter this picture? Well, you see, here you consider gauge. So they choose the gauge group G, right? And if you take the gauge group G and you look at the super young Mills on this product, you get an effective theory on sigma, whose target space is this Hitchian moduli space for G. But of course, what you now want to do is to study S-duality. So in S-duality, you have two different gauge theories, two different Young-Mills theories, one for G and one for LG. So one of them, so the theory for G will give rise to a sigma model with a target MH of G. And the theory for LG will give rise to the theory for the moduli space for LG. And S-duality tells us that these two theories have to be equivalent to each other. Okay? So why are they equivalent? And the answer is that they're equivalent because these two manifolds are mirror dual to each other. In fact, these two sigma models are in the relationship, which is called the mirror symmetry. And this mirror symmetry is actually realized in the most beautiful way by the so-called SYZ mechanism, Strominger-Yau-Zaslow mechanism, that they both fiber over a certain base, which is a vector space, with generic fibers being tori, and these tori are dual to each other. So, in other words, mirror symmetry is realized by T-duality, by fiber-wise T-duality. Okay, so let me... So in fact, you have MH, LG, MH of G, fibering over the same base. There's some map to the same base, which is some complex, some vector space of dimension equal to 1/2 of this. They both have the same dimension. And the fibers, generic fibers are tori. So generic fibers are dual tori. What does it mean that they are dual tori, more precisely? So let's call this base B, and let's pick a point B. So then the fiber here we'll call FBL, and the fiber here will be FB, right? So FB can be identified with the moduli space of line bundles, rather FLB, moduli space of line bundles. It doesn't matter which way, but I want to say it this way. Line bundles on FB with a flat connection. Flat unitary connection. That's what we mean by dual tori. If you have a torus, a dual torus is a moduli space of line bundles with a flat connection, flat unitary connection on that, on the original, on the first torus. Okay? So now, this the two theories, sigma models, are related by mirror symmetry, which means that anything you say about one model has to have an equivalent statement in the other model. And in particular, what we look at here is boundary conditions. As I already explained last time, you look at sigma, which has a boundary. So then to define your theory on the sigma with boundary, you have to impose some boundary condition. And you are in a topological theory, which means that you want these boundary conditions to preserve the kind of supersymmetry that you have in your model. And the point is that mirror symmetry is always a symmetry, well, in this case, anyway, it is a symmetry between two types of sigma models. One is called A model, another one is called B model. So on this side, you have the, I'll erase this B. On this side, you have a B model, topological B model, which means that it depends on the complex structure. And the complex structure we choose is the complex structure J, which means that actually we look at it as this moduli space of flat bundles, exactly the moduli space which appears in the geometric language. So in this case, the category of brains, which are now called B brains, is just the category of coherent sheaves. In other words, to specify a boundary condition, you can, for example, say the boundary lands in some subvariety, in some submanifold. And because you want to preserve the supersymmetry of the B model, the subvariety would have to be a complex subvariety. But then in the language of algebraic geometry, you think of a subvariety as a sheaf supported on this subvariety. So subvariety gives you a coherent sheaf. It is in this sense that a coherent sheaf you can think of as a boundary condition or a B brain. So that's the B model. And this one is called the A model, which means that it actually depends on a symplectic form. And the symplectic form we choose is a symplectic form in which this is actually isomorphic to the cotangent bundle to bundle G. The point is that this moduli space is the moduli space of bundles and Higgs fields, and the Higgs field can be thought of as a cotangent vector of the bundle. This is something that one can easily see. So this has a canonical symplectic form, and then we look at this A model with respect to this symplectic form. And the corresponding category of A brains, is very closely related to what mathematicians call the Foucault category. So, whereas in the B model, a brain was a complex subvariety, say, or a sheaf supported on complex subvariety. In an A model, an A brain would be a Lagrangian subvariety with respect to the symplectic form, and with some additional datum, which, for example, it could be a unitary vector bundle, flat unitary vector bundle, Foucault category. So an example of an object is a pair, a Lagrangian subvariety and now by the flat connection on L. So mirror symmetry predicts that these two categories are equivalent to each other. This is actually something which is often called a homological mirror symmetry. It was actually anticipated by Maxim Kantsevich before sort of physicists started studying these categories in detail. So homological mirror symmetry. So now we are very close to interpreting the geometric Langlands correspondence in terms of this homological mirror symmetry. So let's summarize what we've learned so far. So mathematicians in the mathematical Langlands program, mathematicians want to relate two categories. One of them is the category of coherent sheaves on the moduli space of flat connections on X. Right, so that's one sort of one box. And the other one is a category of D modules on bundle G. So you want to link these two, this is called the geometric Langlands correspondence, and you want to link them in such a way that this equivalence commutes with some natural operators, namely Wilson operators on this side and Hecke operators on this side. Okay? On the other hand, physicists tell us that there is another equivalence of categories coming from mirror symmetry, and that's an equivalence between the category of B brains on the Hitchin moduli space for LG, which actually in complex structure J is just this moduli space. And so this category is just plain equal to this. But it's just this definition of this category. Up to saying the word derived category. Which we want to use anyway, but I'm sort of simplifying things and trying not to overload it with too many terms. So that's on one side of this mirror symmetry, equivalence. And on the other side, we have the category of A brains. On the other Hitchin moduli space, which we look at from a different point of view as a symplectic manifold, which is a cotangent bundle to bunch G. So mirror symmetry is this equivalence. Right. So moreover, Kapustin-Witten show that, and this is something very natural from the fact that you actually got this mirror symmetry from S-duality of the bigger four-dimensional Young-Mills theories, that actually this equivalence intertwines the action of Wilson operators and the so-called Holst operators on this side. So how could you possibly relate this to? Well, the answer is clear. You have to show that these two categories are equivalent. And this is something which Kapustin-Witten argue has nothing to do with Langlands correspondence. That you owe for any manifold, say, let's call Z, instead of bunch G, you should have an equivalence between D module under some favorable circumstances, a category of D modules on Z, and a category of A braids on the cotangent bundle to Z. So this should be some natural statement of sort of micro-local analysis. We know that, you know, we've known for many years that to understand systems of differential equations, we should study the cotangent bundle, so wave fronts and things like that, right? And so assigning an A brain to a D module is a very natural thing, so Lagrangian subvariety. So it's something like a singular support or characteristic variety of the D module. Except that the way actually it works here is it works in a much nicer way than mathematicians had previously realized. So what Kapustin-Witten tell us then is that the Langlands correspondence boils down to two things. One is the mirror symmetry, which is a very natural thing, which we believe for many different reasons, one of which is the S-duality of the four-dimensional Young-Mills theories, and this mysterious equivalence between D modules and A brains. And the last thing I want to say, going back to Marty's question about what to give an example, so I refuse to give sort of nice examples of D modules because I don't know any. But in this case, one can actually describe very clearly the corresponding A brains, at least in the generic situation. So remember, in the original Langlands program, we have this skyscraper sheaf O sub E, which we can think of as a brain, right? So this, it has to propagate through this whole picture, right? So you have this O sub E here, and this should correspond to some A brain, let's call it A sub E, and then it corresponds to the D module. And the D module is complicated, but I can tell you what the A brain is, at least in the generic case. Generic case means that E is a smooth point of this moduli space. So it's a flat bundle which has no automorphisms. So to answer this question, we just have to look at this picture of SYZ T duality. So you see, I now have a point. I have a zero brain, so to speak. So I have the skyscraper sheaf which is supported at a particular point. So let's say this is my point E in a fiber. So it projects down onto some point B in the base. So it's a point of some fiber. And actually, in the generic situation, it's going to be a smooth fiber. It's going to be a smooth torus. Okay? So what's going to be my dual A brain? Well, SYZ tells me that the dual brain would have to be supported on the dual fiber. So what is it? Well, this point, as I said, it's a point E now, a point of this moduli space. And this moduli space parameterizes line bundles on FP with a unitary flat connection. So this point actually gives rise to a particular Lagrangian subvariety, namely the fiber FP, and a flat unitary line bundle, 1A. Why? Because E belongs to this fiber, and this any point of this fiber gives you such a connection on this fiber. So that's why this point gives you precisely the data needed to specify an A brain. Those data are Lagrangian subvariety, that's your fiber. It is actually Lagrangian with respect to the symplectic form, and a flat unitary line bundle. It comes just from the fact that they are dual tori. So what Kapustin-Witten argued is that this is the A-brain, which is dual to this B-brain. And so all you need to do now is to construct the corresponding D-module. If you are a mathematician, you have this D-module, you take this A-brain, it's very nice. So D-module is very complicated, but the A-brain is extremely nice. It's just a generic A-brain, a generic eigenbrain. It's going to be an eigenbrain of these Hofft operators. A generic A-brain is just a Hitchin fiber, just a fiber of this SYZ vibration with some unitary flat line bundle. Okay? And so then what Witten and I did subsequently is that we generalized this analysis to the case of sort of mildest possible singularities in this moduli space, namely orbifold singularities. That if E is not a smooth point, but it is sort of an orbifold point. So we showed how this duality works. It becomes a little bit more complicated. But since I'm out of time, I'll stop here. So thank you very much.
It's not rigorous
at this point. So there are several things which require more rigor. One of them is the definition of this category. So Foucault category, people have been able to define a Foucault category in some cases. For example, for tori, for K3 surfaces and things like that. Right? But in general, it's not clear. There are all kinds of issues.
But your words sound a little bit suspicious because you say that the model is like a differential operator and you're trying to characterize it by some geometric objects like wave fronts.
Right.
Like quasi-classical approximation.
That's right. So it's kind of, it's very surprising because, so naively, you would think if you have a D module, then you can associate it with characteristic variety. And this is going to be conical submanifold in the cotangent bundle. And say if the D module is holonomic, so it's kind of maximally overdetermined system of differential linear PDEs, then this characteristic variety is going to be Lagrangian. But the point is, it's going to be very singular. So, for example, the typical example would be, you know, that you would have, say, just on the line, you have the cotangent bundle, which is a plane, and you would have just a coordinate cross. So, if you have the equation z d dz minus 1, you know, phi equals 0, you will just have this.
Why?
Because you take the symbol of this, it's going to be x, you know, p, zp, whatever. Yeah. Zp equals 0, so this is p equals 0, this is z equals 0. Right? But the brain, which corresponds to it, is like this. It's so the singular
the
support...
captures on this Elysium.
That's right. So that's what I thought you meant by quasi-classical.
Yes.
So in the traditional approach, you take just a quasi-classical thing, which is would be just, you know, zp. So p would be like dz, right? And so your zp equals 0, so it's singular. It's conical and singular. But what Kapustin and Witten tell us is that the brain, the A brain, which corresponds to this, is a kind of a smoothening of this guy. And so at first it looks very unbelievable that it's possible to actually promote this to an equivalence of categories. And they have given some sort of physics arguments why this is true, which is very beautiful. The idea is that actually, in the category of A-brains, in addition to Lagrangian subvarieties, you also have some coisotropic subvarieties allowed. And so there is some what they call big coisotropic brain, which is kind of a space-filling brain here, with some line bundle with a connection, with unitary, non-flat unitary connection. And this, which they call BCC. And then they say that the endomorphisms of this brain is actually the sheaf of differential operators. And so therefore, if you have any test brain B, you can take home from this big BCC brain to B, and that's going to be a D module. So that gives you a functor this way. Right? So that's the kind of Marita equivalence kind of way, constructing this functor. So they have a beautiful argument, which is kind of physics argument. It has not been made rigorous. On the other hand, Nadler and Zaslow, and some follow-up work by Nadler, have given a different way, a different realization of this kind of equivalence of categories. So now people mathematicians are gradually starting to believe that indeed this should be true, at least under some favorable circumstances. That in fact you can relate A-brains to D-modules. And this is the simplest example how it works. So it's not just a classical, traditional way of relating them, but it's like something more sophisticated. It's much nicer.
Other questions? Let's thank Edward for a beautiful series of talks.